Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising. Today, we hear from an industry titan about her career and campaign. In the first half of my conversation with Tamara Rogers, I ask her to talk about her career candidly and with reflection, from her first job to her last. In the second half, she shares her thoughts on management and campaigns. Specifically, Tamara led the Harvard campaign, whose public phase was 2013 to 2018, with an announced goal of $6.5 billion, concluding at over $9.6 billion. Tamara Rogers assumed the position of Vice President for Alumni Affairs and Development at Harvard University in 2007. And retired from a four-decade-long career at the university in November of 2018. Her previous roles at Harvard included Associate Dean for Advancement and Planning at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, Associate Director of University Development and Director of University Capital Projects in the University Development Office, and Director of Major Gifts for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Rogers began her career in the Harvard College Office of Admissions and Financial Aid, ultimately becoming the Director of International Admissions. She has also been an executive search consultant in the firm of Heidrick & Struggles in the education and non-for-profit practice. Rogers is a charter trustee of Phillips Academy, past president of the Phillips Academy Alumni Council, and past president of the Abbott Academy Association. She serves as member of Boston Museum of Fine Arts Advisory Board. Rogers has also served on the American Selection Committee of the United World Colleges. She has been a speaker and facilitator in executive education and master's courses at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, a faculty member at the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education Winter Institute, and a keynote speaker for Women in Development of Greater Boston. Rogers is an associate of the Aspen Leadership Group, an executive search and leadership consulting firm, and an alumna of Harvard College. Now let's get started. Welcome, Tamara.
Thank you, Catherine. It's good to be here.
You retired in 2018. You've had about 2 years now to reflect. I would love for us to start with talking about your career at Harvard. How do you feel about that?
That would be fine. I'll actually even begin with my career in general before Harvard, which is to say when I graduated from college, I had no idea of what I wanted to do at all. I wanted to be able to pay my rent, and I thought maybe public service was interesting, and I got a job as a secretary, now doubtless called an assistant, in a state agency in Massachusetts. And 2 years out of college, I felt bad about myself that I had no notion of what I wanted to do. And I felt as though everyone was sort of more planful and advancing more. And I thought perhaps you should consider what it is that you love the most. And the answer popped up so easily, which was education, school. Every school I'd ever gone to from kindergarten on, every class I'd ever been in, it's not to say that everything was perfect, but I simply loved school. So I thought I should get a job in a school, whatever it is, and that may lead me to perhaps a degree in education or education management, or at least I would be in a setting that meant a lot to me. And so the job that appeared was as an assistant in the Office of Admissions and Financial Aid at Harvard in the Student Employment Office. And that was a great experience. Loved the students, loved working with them. This was before computers. This was jobs on blackboards. And it was not blackboards, actually bulletin boards. It also exposed me to admissions as I would talk to admissions officers about some of the students who came in particularly international students, and how best to understand and work with them. It also was my first management job. I got promoted rather quickly, and then I was put in charge of the office and reported to that director. And I learned something. It was a woman called Martha Lyman. She was the head of financial aid, and she said, "I'm being promoted, and I should ask for more money." That never even occurred to me. And so there was, you know, my first mentor who stayed a mentor. I suspect the college probably thought I would just be honored and leave it at that. In any case, I did indeed. Yes, they weren't surprised, and perhaps they always expected it, but she felt I should be sure to ask because she was taking on, you know, overseeing me and my division, and she was asking for more as well. But it was a generous thing of her to think also about the other person.
Yeah.
After I had my son in 1981, I came back part-time only into admissions. By that time, I was reading files as well as running the office, and I was going to stay part-time for a bit and felt that management probably didn't make sense. And so I became an admissions person, went back full-time after a few years, and eventually became the head of international admissions in Harvard College. All of that experience was 100% fantastic. The move into fundraising was because I felt as though I should learn something new. I felt quite old. I was in my late 30s, but I was bringing up three children. Two of them were rather older. My husband's children from his first marriage lived with us as well. And so I felt like, you know, a pretty old person. I thought, my goodness, that I better learn something new before it's too late. People suggested to me that I should look at fundraising. And like many people who go into not-for-profit work, I didn't think about money much. I knew we had financial aid money at Harvard, and I thought it more or less grew on trees. Fundraising felt a little unsavory in some way. I certainly didn't understand it. And I then met Susan Fagan, who was the head of fundraising for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, of which Harvard College was a part. And she was utterly persuasive, a real role model, another mentor. And I started working in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences as a major gift officer. I was surprised that after a few years, I was promoted to be director of major gifts. And that was really as a result of a person who was my boss, and he was going on to another job and had been pushing me forward. He had given me a book a couple of years before in management, and I really had no idea why, but it clearly was his doing. So I think one hallmark of my career is that I have been fortunate and I've worked with people who are generous, and I hope I've integrated that as I've taken on larger and larger management jobs. I then actually was recruited out of Harvard and joined Heidrick & Struggles, the executive search firm in the education and not-for-profit practice. Did that for a couple of years, and then Harvard basically asked me to come back and take a job within university development, or the whole university, not just Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Came back. That was complicated, as central jobs often are. I think that your listeners might relate if they come from big, complex
institutions. It's a big job, for sure.
I wasn't the top person there, but it was a complicated job. And then another sort of thing happened that sent my career in not a brand new direction, but to another location within the university. And that was that Radcliffe College merged with Harvard University. Although classes had been coeducational, housing had been coeducational, Radcliffe still had a separate legal identity. It's strange and too long to discuss, but the merger was occurring, and it was Radcliffe was going to become an institute for advanced study. I approached Neil Rudenstein, the president of Harvard at the time, as an old Radcliffe alum, and said I had some concern about the new person they were bringing in as the founding dean, and whether that person would have good exposure to the culture, really robust culture of volunteerism and philanthropy at Harvard, because Radcliffe had been so separate, and because the merger was not met with universal acclaim by Radcliffe alums. There was some, you know, sense of concern. Right. And so he and I cooked up a little plan for me to meet her before she actually started the job and introduce her to some of our donors as the dean of Harvard's sort of newest entity. And we hit it off and we started talking about working together when she was to arrive, which was some months hence. And that was Drew Faust. I thought she was terrific. I thought it was new. Harvard didn't have, you know, like a new school, so to speak. I had a sense of loyalty to Radcliffe. And the mission was fascinating, which was research, not exclusively focused on women, but with an emphasis. So I ended up becoming the first advancement dean at the Radcliffe Institute. And I assumed, actually, that that would be my last job, if I felt like an old person in my late 30s at that point. Yes. Lo and behold, she ended up as the president of Harvard after 7 or 8 years at the Radcliffe Institute. And I went through the search and became vice president for alumni affairs and development. So if I were to sum it up, I would say confusion, self-examination around what I loved, a lot of luck. And, you know, I won't pretend that I didn't work hard, but I think people really underestimate the role of simple chance in career development.
Well, and it sounds like, too, people recognized you as someone they wanted to bring along, like the gift of the book on management.
That was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I only as we started talking about this, did I see it as a pattern. I was very conscious of people being supportive. But they were all different people in different places. And so I hadn't seen it as a thread. But now it really does feel like a thread in a way. When I became vice president, it was certainly the case that there were people who were cautious about that and described me as Drew Faust's top assistant. People who asked me more than one, how it felt to work for, and then they'd name a man who worked for me. It seemed to be harder for some of the, I have to say, traditional male volunteers to envision me as the vice president, although I was the second woman vice president. There was another woman who preceded me who was there just for a couple of years before she left. I benefited from a lot of her good work. And so that was a barrier in a way and gave me a lot of motivation to do a very good job. And it wasn't the first time, even in admissions, I was interested in a sort of more complicated area to take on. And I was told at the time that as a mother working part-time, that the alums would not feel that they were getting what they deserved. Until I had a woman boss, and she handed me a really interesting, complicated area. And I said, well, will the alums be okay? And she said, what, are you kidding me? I have had men as mentors. But I would say that I've been particularly fortunate to have encountered very supportive women along the way.
Yeah, you mentioned Susan Fagan. What has her relationship been like with you? How has it ebbed and flowed over the years?
She's a great manager and strategist. She's professional. She's humane. She is hands-on in the sense that she really pays attention to the people who work for her. But she wants very much also for them to succeed. She's not hands-on controlling. And she was definitely a feminist at the time when I went into the field in 1990. And it was quite male-dominated. Now, of course, it's heavily female, and we can talk about that a bit later, except at the very top. And she had a top job in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and she was extremely smart about being a woman leader. I will mention one other mentor, and that was a man who'd worked at Harvard for decades and still is. I'd known him slightly as an undergraduate, really got to know him in fundraising. And I described him once as a person who is like the way Helen Keller is said to have spoken of Annie Sullivan, although I can't find a citation. It's alleged that she said she, Annie Sullivan, her teacher, was not conscious of my weakness. Now, that's ridiculous. Of course, Annie Sullivan knew what Helen Keller's weaknesses are, but she clearly made Helen Keller feel empowered. Mm-hmm. And Jack Reardon was that kind of person to so many people. He built confidence because he had such belief in people. So I would say that was another very important mentor.
Can you think of an example that would describe that?
When I was going to be promoted to be director of major gifts, I felt very cautious and nervous. I'd had a management job in admissions, but very small, and I was nervous about it. And I was promoted over the heads of some people who had been there for quite a bit longer than I had been there. The idea that Jack, who was very well embedded in the system, just looked at me and said, "I believe you can do anything." And that was just a striking statement. It was just such an affirmation. And it didn't make me feel I could do anything, but it made me feel like, well, then surely I can step up to this. And one funny anecdote, when people would say to me, "How does it feel to work for and name a man who worked for me?" my response was always to look them in the face and say, "Well, actually, he works for me and he's excellent." But when people would say, "How does it feel to work for Jack Reardon?" I would say, "It feels fantastic." Because he was such an icon, and he was executive director of the Alumni Association. And in a way, we all, in one way or another, worked.
Oh, I love it. So let's talk a little bit about Harvard. And do you want to start with the campaign? Where do you want to go?
Sure. The campaign had its public launch in 2013. I became VP in 2007 in October, but the market crashed in 2008. So there were obviously delays. We had a new president. We'd had a presidency that had ended in a, you know, challenging way. There were just a lot of reasons why Harvard hadn't had a campaign since the last one ended in 1999. So that's a long time for most institutions to go between campaigns. Couldn't really launch ours publicly until 2013. The quiet phase was a couple of years before that, in order to have a sense that we could succeed at it, given the market circumstances. This was going to be the first campaign in which every single school of Harvard participated. We had some things in mind. One was that we wanted to break the big gift barrier. Harvard had never raised the biggest gifts. It had raised the most money until the campaign Stanford had just had, but we had not cracked the biggest gifts. We, in the earlier campaign and subsequently, had hoped to cross boundaries internally more effectively, encourage giving to the part of Harvard that meant the most to them or where the work was the most interesting or helped them achieve their philanthropic objectives. And we were able to do that, although we still have a long way to go. I would be lying if I said, and then we changed everything entirely. And wasn't that a marvelous miracle? Harvard has a long tradition of really robust volunteerism. And we wanted to sustain that, which we did. We had advisory groups, we had campaign committees, we had many alums or non-alums in some cases who served on more than one school's campaign council. We had an executive committee that was university-wide that included all the heads of the school campaigns. Less good was that we obviously fell short on some priorities. Obviously, academic leadership hopes and believes that every bucket will be filled. We know that that's not the case, and so that can feel disappointing to people. And another thing that I said to the corporation in my last talk to them before I left is that we definitely fell short on diversity. And that was both in engaging donors and in staff recruitment. And that's something that I hope will be advanced going forward. It's absolutely imperative. You should aspire big, but value all gifts. Because we raised some really huge gifts, there were sometimes people, it could be people on the team, academic leaders, others, who felt, why are we not just, you know, basically going elephant hunting? And that obviously is because elephants are unicorns. And because for educational institutions, you have the market advantage of creating new affiliates every single year. And you squander that at your own risk. You don't just turn up later in someone's life and say, "Well, hey, I discovered you've been really successful." And so to value all gifts as well as aspiring big, which as I said, to break that big gift barrier. And then I mentioned volunteerism, to think of volunteerism not just as who would be out there raising money amongst the donors and asking, but who would be good advisors? Who would help us with communication strategy? Who might not want to be a solicitor, but was a great thinker? We had a person in one major city who would notice when younger people gave, you know, really significant major gift, and he'd just call them up and take them out to lunch. That matters. He said it had happened to him before, and it just imprinted him. And we saw women come into their own much, much more in the campaign. Susan Fagan and I and another woman had started a Women in Leadership Task Force in the 90s in hopes of getting a focus on women's philanthropy.
What was the pursuit like, though, of growing and cultivating those 8 and 9-figure gifts for the campaign?
It was focus. It was having some very good fundraisers, in particular, a particularly strong principal gifts fundraiser. It was thinking, working obviously with academic leadership on what were the biggest ideas. And importantly, there were some deans who were willing to, again, allow, so to speak, their alumni to cross boundaries one way they felt it would yield the biggest gift. But it was thinking, as for all major gift fundraising, who could be heard? Whom could this person hear? Which voice would mean the most? Not whose job title. But in some cases, it might be a peer, whether that peer was asking or simply doing lead-up work. In some cases, obviously, it might be faculty, obviously, often the president, a dean, but to be very thoughtful and strategic about that and not make assumptions. It could be surprising sometimes to see who people would listen to. So that mattered. It's very bespoke work. We're all sort of administration in one way or another. And so again, to think not of the job title, but of who can make the most impact. And interestingly, in some of the very biggest gifts, the person who was managing it was more behind the scenes and just determining, okay, who's next? I'll say one other thing about the campaign, and that had to do with the goal. And I took a cue from Stanford. When we hit our goal of $6.5 billion with the corporation's endorsement and with a lot of lead volunteers, but not all agreed by a long shot, we did not announce a new goal, but we kept raising money until what we had declared to be the 5-year temporal end of the campaign. We didn't attract a lot of attention and we did not risk falling short of setting a new goal when it would have been a marvelous achievement in any case, but people would have felt like they failed. And so I had learned from Martin Schell, the VP of Stanford at the time, that they had taken this approach, and I thought it was brilliant and it worked really well for us.
And you ultimately ended with?
Just north of $9.6 billion.
So exciting.
It was quite exciting. That's not to say there wasn't a person here or there who felt we failed, because why didn't we hit 10? No, we were happy.
What would you say remains true about the profession as we navigate through this tremendous change and look into the future?
Yeah, in a way, I was concerned about this podcast because everything I'm talking about was pre-COVID. And pre the sort of social justice issues that have arisen with such justifiable force. One is that one way or another, even through a screen, you are working with people, with their values, their decision-making, their motivations. Another is that philanthropy is voluntary in its very nature. You can't make anyone do anything. I know that occasionally we sit around a table and someone says, well, she should do this, or he should do that. The fact is, maybe they should in our minds, but in the real world, it's entirely up to them. It's their money. That's not going to change. And that's why understanding motivation, what appeals to someone, whose voice do they hear that will have the most impact, will, I believe, remain very important. There's the old saying, ask for money and you get advice, ask for advice and you get money. Asking for advice is just super smart. It's smart professionally because you actually are going to learn a lot And I always ask for advice throughout my entire career, probably up until the day that I stepped out of the role of vice president. And I learned a lot. And asking for advice from your prospective donors, your volunteers, helps you learn more about them. It also helps when they talk about what other philanthropy they do, how they feel other institutions are doing. The more curiosity you have, the more knowledge you want to absorb, the better you're able, you're going to be at thinking of how to inspire the philanthropy, and you'll learn. But that's not to say there are obviously very big changes. Technology, means and modes of communication, speaking to different audiences, facing what feels most important to philanthropists now, what feels most relevant as they look at COVID and other issues around race and justice. And even before that, universities were facing a lot of, shall we say, barriers around their relevance, around whether they were too politically correct, around whether they actually helped people, whether their knowledge was sufficiently applied, whether they were too rich. You know, you could name myriad things with which we've been assailed in the more recent past. And also, obviously, belief in the cause.
You have to believe in what you're fundraising for.
Yeah. And I would say also then a couple of other things. Another is to recognize that fundraising can bring out not the best in people. People can become very territorial. They can sort of lose track of what their job is. Are they working for the donor? Are they the donor's friend? Or are they actually working for the institution? And so to kind of watch out for that. And again, Susan was wonderful at talking about it at the very beginning of my career as something to notice. And then I have found that there's a difference between sincerity and what people always talk about as authenticity. Sometimes what you want to sincerely achieve is not exactly what your authentic self wants to do. So my authentic self swears a lot, but I sincerely wanted to achieve a successful campaign, a united team, a positive workplace environment, good volunteerism. Sometimes, not infrequently, one acts in a way looking at how, a person you admire would behave in a situation. And that's not to say you're inauthentic in the sense of hiding who you are, or, you know, people sometimes talk about not being allowed to sort of be themselves in some core essential ways. So I don't mean that kind of authenticity, but I mean more really being intentional about how to get to where you want to go. I don't mean professionally in terms of the job ladder, but what you want to achieve within any job.
Acting as your highest self, I guess.
Yes, or in my case, sometimes emulating someone else's higher self.
Right.
Being very proud of myself for being able to do that and finding that it worked.
It's a good point. I like that one. The difference between sincerity and authenticity, it's interesting. Well, thank you for all of the things you've shared. It's been wonderful to hear about your experiences.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Can I close with one description of fundraising?
Absolutely.
I would always hear about art and science. And I would say that fundraisers certainly like to think of it as an art. Who doesn't want to be an artist? And also because of the lack of predictability. And often academic leaders want to think of it as a science because they feel that, you know, they're planning their budgets around this and their academic plans. And I would say I think of it as a craft and a sport. And not an art and not a science. And it's a craft because it's meant to be useful and sort of hand done, but it also is beautiful in its way. And a sport because it's so often best done in teams and it's so darn competitive.
Is that what you know for sure, Tamara?
I would say I think I know that for sure.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was good to talk to you.
I'm grateful to Tamara for giving us a rare glimpse into the mindset of a billion-dollar leader. Tamara's numbers speak for themselves, and yet, hearing context and hindsight from her is a rich opportunity. Tamara reminded us that our donors are just people. The same is true of our leaders. Hearing their stories is one of my favorite parts of hosting this podcast. If you want to learn more about her mentor, Susan Fagan, feel free to scroll down to hear more on her episode, She Opened the Door. Thank you, and we'll talk again soon.